friends. Welcome to another episode of the 10 Laws Podcast with East Forest. I'm East Forest, coming to you today from southern Utah, where I just got to have a great conversation with my dear friend Christopher Shin. That was back in episode 69. So I do recommend you going back in the logs of the East Forest podcast and listening to that conversation if you haven't already, because it'll give you a bit of history about Chris and his personal journey. But Chris is just a great mind and a very thoughtful, sensitive thinker who has a different lexicon and perspective than mine, of sort of like a soul perspective. And his is more of, I don't want to put him in a box, but sort of from like psychology and archetypes. And it's great because I like to sort of be hearing things from different angles. And I think you'll appreciate this conversation for that as well. Chris is a very talented and accomplished playwright and writer. He's also a teacher. He lives in New York City currently. And yeah, we're going to dive into it, and you can see more about his world by clicking on the link about him in the show notes. Thank you for reviewing the podcast. It just takes a moment, and thank you for subscribing. That makes a big difference to hit that subscribe button. It's really not that big a deal. It just means you're a subscriber. You don't have to listen, but we like being in conversation with everybody. And thank you for those who have reviewed the podcast. And if you want to say hi, you can also do that by emailing info@eastforest.org. We're trying to get over the 200 mark in the ratings. We're getting there on iTunes podcast. So thanks for doing that if you can. We had a review from Solaro Surfer. It's a cool name. Thanks for the 5 stars. It says, fantastic podcast, positive vibe. East Forest always brings interesting, thoughtful guests and topics to the podcast, like his original music. It's beautiful and hopeful. Mind expanding. Thanks. Thank you. You know, things like that, it'll probably help someone who hasn't heard this podcast yet. Maybe they'd be like, I'll give it a listen. And I appreciate your support in this free offering. Other housekeeping is just to let you know that the Spores vinyl is still available. It's in its first limited edition printing of 300. If you'd like to get a copy, you can grab that only at eastforest.org. Click on the music tab. And the Spores Ceremony live stream concert is still on YouTube at East Forest Music. It's also on the eastforest.org. So if you want to take that journey, you still can. It's a little over 3 hours of improvisational live ceremony style music of mine. And I thought we hit some really beautiful moments together with the folks that joined in. And it's a relaxing musical journey you can really partake in however you wish. You can do that as a medicine journey, but you could also just put it on to sleep to relax to, as a family, as an individual. So dive in. And I'll be playing in person on October 22nd in Boise, Idaho with Magic Sword. There may be some tickets left, but I know it's going real fast because it's outdoors. Everyone has a little pod of space. It's at the Botanical Garden. So I'm just sort of down here rehearsing for that. I pretty much wrapped up mixing the new Possible album right before I left. And so I'm just trying to shift gears a bit and, I don't know, do whatever you do after you finish a major project. Not that it's finished, but, you know, it's sort of like the creative process hit a massive milestone for me. I've just been trying to enjoy, or I am enjoying, the incredible stars here and taking saunas and going on walks. The fall time is just incredible everywhere, but particularly down here in the high desert of southern Utah. There is a magic in the air of change and a magic of a continuation of the cycles of life. And I know things are real nuts out there. And I know we're all going through, this election is intense, and we're still experiencing the burning of the fields and the collapse. But these conversations are ways of walking each other through it, not to provide a singular answer, because there isn't one, but to witness one another and to sing more notes in the chorus. So on that note, let's dive into this wonderful conversation with our dear friend, Christopher Shin. Thanks, Chris. Thanks, Christopher Shin. Always good to be talking to you, an old friend, and talking to you again. I value you know, your counsel as a friend, but I also have just been really moved by your perspective on things. And I want to reflect back on when you were on, I guess it was Patreon, and you took a break, and we talked about that and sort of the motivations for stepping away. And a lot of people have been going through those feelings in different ways of sort of reassessing, just sort of getting the shit kicked out of them in one way or another to just sort of stop. But things are so systemic in how they're changing and shifting on the personal level and on the global level, community level. So where are you at right now? I just want to go right to the core of it and see how you're feeling about the state of the state, both in your heart and in the world.
Well, that's a good question. And, you know, one reason I was happy that you reached out to talk again is I feel like our conversation will help me actually to answer that question, because I'm really not sure. And I go back and forth. I think, like a lot of people, I have a lot of different moods at different times, and it's very hard to predict where one mood is leading me, how long a mood will last, and it's hard to integrate them as well, I find. So no pressure, but I'm hoping our conversation is going to help me.
Well, let me just say something right there. I mean, you're bringing up my own like failings of my own mind, and that I'm looking for an answer. And I think that's what's so powerful about this time, is that there really isn't one. Not that there ever has been, but we're kind of grasping for something on the shore to hold on to in a time when, like just like in birth, you don't know what's on the other side. If you're inside or on the outside, you don't know what's going to come out, or a snake shedding its skin. Like we're in process. Like whatever it is, it's becoming. And even if it ever had a destination, but we're very much in this fertile time where the fields are still being burned. And who knows what will grow after that?
Absolutely. And I think the lack of a timeline, the inability to chronologically project into the future. I mean, that may be a feature of life in general. We never know what's going to happen to us. We never know what's in store. But it's rarely this concrete. You know, it's rarely there's a virus that is making its way through the world, and we're not sure how we're going to stop it and when we're going to stop it. And, you know, even if a lot of our relationship to time is an illusion or a fantasy, that it still gives us some structure that, you know, can be really helpful in organizing your day, organizing your month, organizing your year, organizing your relationships. And so to have something like really concrete happening that doesn't have any truly predictable chronology or narrative arc to it, I think it's really, really hard. And, you know, unlike just a molecular level, I mean, from the most kind of quotidian minutia of our lives to our grandest plans. And, you know, I think we're all kind of trying to figure out how to live in that uncertainty and unpredictability. And, you know, amidst that, we have a political situation that is, you know, really bad. And, you know, again, it's like the political situation on some level is always bad. Like, yeah. It's not like anything is new in some extraordinary way, but it's more visible, it's more present. And I think that adds to the challenge too, of just, well, how do you live when you're amidst so much uncertainty and so much destruction? And, you know, I think I've tried lots of different things, but I certainly know that I have not found any solution that I would say is has proved particularly lasting or I think would be something, you know, I could model for others. I mean, I really do think I'm stumbling through like everybody else.
Last time we talked, we were talking about some of your you know, long ago history with health and a battle with cancer and the loss of your leg. And I think about in this time now, about not just our mental health, but our physical health, like the kind of just how stress affects the body and the things we're going through and how that plays a role in our overall well-being. And it seems like, I mean, in the early parts of the pandemic, I had a couple meltdowns of anxiety. I'm sure that was exacerbated by other stuff going on, but I felt stronger since July, and I could get into why I think that is, but I say a lot stronger. But nonetheless, do you think about like what the factors of loneliness and despair and how this might be playing into like our well-being and our minds and our bodies and our hearts? And do you think about that yourself, like personally?
You know, I do think about it. I mean, for those who didn't listen to our first conversation.
They should. It's a great story and a very personal and honorable. I'll make sure to link to which number it is. I don't have it on top of my head.
But I can't remember if I said this explicitly in that talk or just more alluded to it. But I remember when I was, you know, still actively sick and, you know, in very intensive treatment and had been given a very bleak prognosis. My then partner left me. And around that time, I read, there was some study, and, you know, I don't have all the scientific detail at my fingertips, but the gist of the study was that they injected mice with tumors, and they half the mice they let sleep normal sleep rhythms, and half the mice they woke up every few hours or something.
It's poor mice.
And yeah, and the mice they woke up, their tumors progressed much more rapidly, and they died much more quickly. And at the time, I remember thinking, like, I'm not sleeping well because the emotional pain of my partner leaving me, and I'm waking up all the time. And I was really worried. I remember reaching out to friends and saying that I felt like, you know, I was at a real disadvantage not having, you know, love and care and touch and going through that trauma at that time. And it's, you know, funny that you bring that up because I just had scans down at NIH, and then were my first scans since the pandemic. The last time I had been there was February, so just as things were getting started in America. And I had a similar fear. I mean, I have a partner now and, you know, feel lots of love, but on just the level of isolation, you know, not being as physically active, of not being able to hug friends, not seeing people, not interacting. I had a very similar fear that I wasn't going to be as healthy. And, you know, thank God I was okay. But, you know, I do think that these things that we may take for granted, like seeing a friend, hugging a friend, being able to have a pleasant conversation with a stranger, you know, being able to move your body freely without worrying or carrying the stress of how close you are to other people. I mean, these simple things, I think they do make a huge difference. And I always think back to that mice study as, you know, something that seems undeniable to me, that if you are having to carry a lot of stress, you're going to have a harder time staying physically healthy. And, you know, we still don't know. There's so much we still don't know about the relationship between the mind and the body. And I, you know, feel like that has to be apparent to everyone now. I mean, I don't know anybody.
I hope so.
Who said, oh, I feel so much better. Maybe there's some really shy people who've enjoyed this lockdown. But I think most people would have to feel like, wow, I literally feel different having less access to other human beings. And it's really challenging.
I've been noticing a lot in my dreams. Like, I don't know what your dreams are like, but masks appear in my dreams, and they have since the beginning of this in different ways, whether it's stressful or not stressful, but they're just like this ever-present character in almost all of my dreams. It's kind of nuts. And I feel like I have no control over how this is playing out in the background of my psyche. And I find that that's sort of a doorway. It gives me some kind of glimmer into what's going on in there. I don't really know what to do with it. But do you pay attention to your dreams much? And have you been seeing anything interesting?
First I want to ask you though, are the masks always the same? Are they different? Or like how varied are the masks in your dreams?
Well, it's often either like people are wearing them or I'm wearing them, or it's like directly related to the masks. Like, where are they, or why I'm the only one wearing them, or the other way around. Like, I can't find one. And it's a stress about that in particular. So it's not like one particular mask. It's just sort of like this theme of masks.
Hmm. I mean, I think they protect us, but they also limit intimacy. And one thing I noticed when I did start seeing friends again outside, we keep our masks on. And it was just so different to only have somebody's eyes. And, you know, the eyes communicate a lot. And sometimes you could kind of sense from the facial muscles, like what the rest of the person's face, you know, might be doing. But it still felt very strange to me. And like we were being robbed of intimacy, even as we were, you know, getting able to be a little more intimate. There was still something, you know, preventing, you know, full, genuine intimacy. And I think, too, that masks are such a symbol of a reality that can't be denied, which I think is why so many people want to deny their reality. You know, they're just a reminder of, you know, we don't control everything. And there's things that happen that, you know, have nothing to do with our wishes and desires. And I, you know, I think it's, again, that's like always been a part of life, but it's not easy to live that way all the time. You want to be able to have moments of fantasy where you do control things and everything is in your power. And it, you know, to be constantly reminded of all the reality that, you know, exists outside of our intention and desire. I just think that's, again, it's hard. It's stressful.
I never thought of it that way, about sort of a process of control. It's like, it's sort of reversed from what I would have thought. Like, we often feel very separate. It's sort of like an Eastern idea. When you feel less separate, you're more like, oh, I'm one with the universe and we're all connected. Whereas by not wearing a mask, maybe it sort of helps strengthen deep down that feeling like, no, I am in control, meaning like, and that's actually increasing that sense of separation. Now, I'm an isolated being, and the outside thing, like whatever's going on it's not going to harm me, or it's not going to be like, if you wear a mask in a way, you're saying like, no, I'm part of the environment too. And I recognize that virus is a thing, and I could get it. I could get sick. These are all potentialities. There's some kind of denial. I know it's couched in like freedom and things like that, or all sorts of other things, but maybe underneath that, you know, by saying, I don't want to wear a mask beyond it's uncomfortable or something like that, or it's encroaching on my personal freedoms. Maybe it's some kind of like ego thing. Like it's sort of saying, I'm this being and I'm more powerful that way.
Yeah. I mean, I think that has to be part of it. And I think that fits with, you know, the way our president has dealt with his illness. You know, when I was going down to NIH, I was arriving just as he was leaving Walter Reed, and NIH and Walter Reed are literally across the street from each other in Bethesda, Maryland. And, you know, I watched him kind of bluster, you know, once he got back to the White House, you know, bluster about his illness and, you know, use a lot of language that, you know, suggested, you know, magical powers and unusual robustness, you know, and I just thought, wow, this is powerful stuff. You know, this is what a lot of people at least want to believe.
It's true. It's true. I mean, to be honest with you, all this stuff is going on and things are volatile and falling apart, but there's a big part of me since the summer that is also feeling hopeful. And I feel like a little bit guilty about that. Like, I don't talk about it too much, but it's growing more and more inside me where I can't help feeling that whatever is happening feels like a really necessary process. And I'm not at all discounting the suffering. And I see all that too, but I also sense that something's needing to happen. And like, there really are infinite possibilities in front of us. And there are a lot of very challenging. I actually think it will get worse as far as the difficulties we face, much worse probably. But I also sense like it's the path that we're meant to be on, in a sense. Like, there's like a warrior energy there. There's sort of like, you know, the battle has arrived in a way, and the battle is more about allowing or letting go of things, of transforming into, like, there's doorways in front of all of us that are in our personal, very intimate parts of our minds and our hearts. And only we can choose how we step into those. And you don't have to, like, you can walk through this how you want. But I do feel like what I sense from talking to friends, there's like little changes and sometimes big changes that they're considering or thinking about. And that would, if everyone made those sorts of shifts, make some pretty drastic changes on this planet. But nonetheless, it starts from that individual. And some of them might seem quite mundane. Like, how would that affect the world? You know, if I change like my morning routine or something bigger, like how I work or where I work or how I relate to my friends or how much I travel or all these sorts of things. Are you going through that process personally at all?
I think I am. Even though I'm confused about that as well, but let me bracket that for a second and just answer the dream question, because it actually was interesting. You know, in the first part of the lockdown, I couldn't remember my dreams. And like, I really value my dreams so much, and they've always, you know, been a source of, I don't know if comfort is the word, but I've always felt like if I remember a dream, then I know I have evidence of what's happening in my psyche, and it's something I didn't consciously control. So I trust it more than anything, because it feels to me like, you know, it's...
Oh, right. Authentic.
It's authentic. It's the least, the least delusional, you know,
right,
thought or feeling I can have about myself, because I wasn't awake to get in the way of it and shape it in the way that is most pleasing to me. So I was really upset, and I texted a friend who used to share dreams with me a lot, and I said, "Hey, can we keep a dream journal together? You know, maybe that'll help us remember if, you know, we have a Google document where we're both putting our dreams in." So for a few months we did that, and it was really helpful. You know, I found myself remembering, for whatever reason, knowing that my friend would read the dream seemed to help me remember them more. And then my friends kind of stopped reporting dreams, and I just kept going for months and months. I kept in the document, and then I was like, all right, my friend is never coming back to this document. I should be able to remember my dreams, even if nobody's reading them. So I started my own little document. Anyway, I would say maybe a month ago, I decided that there was something maybe narcissistic at a certain point where I was living too much inside myself, that the obsessive attempt to chronicle all my dreams, you know, really remember them, write them down in detail, that I was, that I had maybe reached a limit, and it was no longer about knowing myself or understanding myself so much as it was about hiding, going into myself to protect myself from the trauma of the world. So I then thought, let me just like try to remember my dreams without writing them down. And if I wake up and forget a dream, that's fine, you know. So I've kind of gone full circle from feeling like this is the most important thing for me to know my psyche right now, to this was maybe getting in the way of a certain kind of living, and I'm going to let it go.
Well, what was coming up though in the dreams? Is there something? Was there a consistency of themes or ideas that was uncomfortable, or that you didn't want to, or that you were cultivating? You think?
Well, you know what? I think you'll find this amusing. there was one theme that kept coming up over and over and over again. And it was me as an actor. I was an actor in so many dreams, sometimes performing on stage, sometimes, you know, backstage, but sometimes I was singing. And I really, I still feel like I don't actually understand why, because this was not a theme of my dreams in any notable way before the lockdown. You know, maybe there's like a simple explanation that not seeing as many people, I just had an urge in my unconscious to exhibit myself and, you know, be paid attention to. But I feel like it has to be more than that. I feel like there has to be something deeper to explain why all of a sudden it was, you know, it was multiple times a week. I would have a dream in which I was an actor.
If you were an actor, was that anxiety ridden? Like, were you like looking for a script or worried about performing, or was it enjoyable?
It was often quite enjoyable, but it was also very often mad. Like, the plays and musicals I was in were manic. They were superficial. They felt in some way decadent, you know. It wasn't like I was doing deep works of art and really connecting, you know. It was like a more like a circus. And you know, and that could easily be a representation just of the world, you know, that we live in, that it's hard to find depth and truth, and you know, there's always a lot of nonsense.
I see it that way, but also with a different bent on it, that in your psyche sees it like the play of life as a game and a circus and silly, and there's a confidence and fun and play for you being like, hey, I'm not taking this that seriously. It's like kind of a message of, it's okay. Like, it's all just like a game in a way. It's all the circus. And the fact that you're enjoying like the role play inside of it, and even being lost in it, lost in the role, is like not a problem. And you're like, you're doing things like singing, and which I don't think you do a lot in normal life. I mean, I hope you do, but I don't, not that that's not something I know of you as like a singer.
I mean, I loved singing as a kid, but and I love music, but yeah, I'm not in the church choir or you know, karaoke maybe once a year when,
in your dreams, you're singing in your dreams.
Yeah.
I have the actor dream, but I'm always looking for a script. I can never find the script. I have that one over and over again.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I mean, that kind of classic anxiety actor dream has not really been a part of my dream life. But I feel like that leads to, you know, the question you asked afterwards, because I do think, like, I have wanted to make changes to my life. I've had lots of ideas. And I feel like, wow, life is really serious. And I want to take it seriously. Even if, you know, in my dream life, everything's a circus and a game, I have felt more than ever like I don't want to play the game. I don't want to participate in the madness and nonsense and mania that, you know, are just a part of the arts and show business, you know, that just is part of what they are. And I feel, I'm glad you feel hopeful. I don't know that I feel hopeless, but I definitely feel confused about what actually is possible. So just like give a very specific example. Like, it seemed really clear to me that, like, I don't really want to live in a city anymore. Like, I don't really understand why I'm spending so much rent on a very small space in, you know, a city that, you know, for all its remaining benefits and charms and history, isn't, you know, it hasn't been a great place to live for a while. You know, it's very corporate. I find it, you know, basically superficial and a playground for the rich. And, you know, so much of life happens online now in a way that also, you know, I find unappealing, where there's just, you know, constant performativity on social media, and, you know, it can also be enjoyable, and I understand that. But, you know, I felt like I don't want to be in a city, and I don't want to be living my virtual social media life for hours and hours every day. I want something quieter. I want, you know, more space. I want to be in nature. And, you know, like when I look at like house prices and, you know, think about how that would work, it doesn't seem impossible by any stretch of the imagination, but still something about making a change like that feels really big and feels really, really scary. And I don't know, maybe I doubt that I'll do it. And I doubt that friends of mine who say they want to do it will do it, only because that it does feel, for whatever reason, that the circus of life, like the circus of commerce and business and the circus of social media, that that really is where life happens still. And to leave that just takes you out of the game. I think that's my fear.
Yeah, I hear that fear. And as just so listeners know, you're in New York City. And when I left New York City, that was more than 10 years ago, 11 or 12 or something. But it is a big deal. It's a big deal to move anywhere. And that's for something, there's this inexorable pull with New York City that's really different, especially for when you've been there a long time. And I don't think that if you were to leave any place, especially the city itself, that it would take you out of that online digital landscape that we live a lot of our lives. But I hear in you like that hunger that I felt too. You know, here I am sitting in Southern Utah doing this podcast, and it absolutely has its inconveniences, but that's kind of that's the reason why it's so rich. I mean, the highlight of my day yesterday was I just have a sauna here and this fifth wheel trailer. I don't own the land yet, so I haven't built anything except the sauna, but the sauna's amazing. There's a cold dunk outside. I was taking a sauna. I take the cold dunk and I'm sitting on this bench outside, and you're totally naked and your body's warm and the stars are like unreal. You know, like the Milky Way is just powered over my head. And I'm like, this is what humans have seen for millennia, and certainly for a long time, right here, sitting right here, there are people seeing these same stars in the same way. And the meaning there was nothing else to do. There was no screen to look at. It was just like, yeah, of course you're going to pay attention and start to memorize them all and talk about them, and it would be a big influence on your lives. And it awakens something in me that's part of our beingness and our DNA and our humanness. And something happened with the Industrial Revolution when we started to create more light and electricity and air pollution, and where you couldn't really see the stars as much. And I think it changed the human psyche in a way we haven't fully given enough credence to how deep that goes. And there's many, many layers of this. And I think the pinnacle of it, in some senses, is social media now. And I watched that Netflix documentary, I think it's called Social Dilemma or something like that. It's fantastic. And it's a lot of things I've been thinking about and talking about, but it's just put into this really potent message about what this stuff is doing to us. And now the last 10 years, roughly, of this social experiment we've been doing with social media and really the smartphone and the iPhone in general, and how that's changed us and how that's changed the world and how it's played a role in the polarization that we're seeing and sensing, and how it's even created things like Donald Trump. You know, he is a court jester that has been birthed out of that exact mechanism. He wouldn't exist if it wasn't for even like reality TV was an early form of like all this stuff. So I almost feel like that hunger people are feeling is something we really should listen to, because I really feel that that is our pathway. That is some kind of future. And it's not the other extreme where we have to go to places like Boulder, Utah, of 200 people. Not at all. But I do feel like if you're feeling that and you're hearing that echoed in your friends, there's something there. And you don't have to leave New York City. It's just easier if you did. You know, there's any path can work. But, we're inside a sort of a crumbling concrete jungle system that is very corporate. I agree with you. And that is the system that we're trying to, like, awaken from in a sense because it's so dehumanized. I know that's a lot of ideas I just said, but I just want to say, like, I hear that you want to leave, and in some way, I felt that too. And when I did leave, it was like, yeah, now it made a lot of sense. I was like, of course. Like, I thought it was this huge thing, and I could never do it, and my life would be over in a way. It was the total opposite. Everything just started to really take off. It opened so many doors for me energetically.
I mean, that's great. And gives me hope. To give voice to my cynical or pessimistic side, I think what I worry that I'm addicted to the game or the circus on some level. The reason I'm in this and the reason I'm still in it, you know, despite being dissatisfied with it, you know, probably for most of my career, you know, on some level, increasingly as the years went on. But, you know, I don't think I ever really thought it was good or sane or anything. Mm-hmm. I worry. I mean, this is like another kind of silly example, but it's specific, which can be helpful. Yeah, I remember thinking like this year the Emmys weren't going to be that big a deal. Like my friends wouldn't all be into the Emmys. Like who's going to win the Emmy? And like they were more into it than ever. And I thought, okay, there is, you know, and I think that the social dilemma does a really good job too of showing the manipulations that keep us attached to the circus, to the mania, to the distraction, that these things are appealing. And even if there's, you know, our shadow rejects it and knows it's bad and feels how destructive it is, there's something that, you know, keeps us coming back. And, you know, maybe my fear is that I can't break my addiction on some level, that it's stronger than my will for something else. But also maybe I am afraid that the world can't, you know, that like really I am, even if I have the strength to really change my life and do something different and be somewhere different, the world is going to continue to invest more and more in the circus and in the game. And I'm just going to be really alone. Almost like it's a choice between existing in the world as it is or creating a life as far outside of the world as possible. And so, you know, you bring up the Industrial Revolution and, you know, I think that, you know, the link to capitalism is so important in all these things because it really can feel like you are just sort of left with two choices. You either participate in this system or you situate yourself on the outskirts of it and you find a way to make your money, but it isn't at the center of your life. And so I think in my mind, at least, those are the two extremes. And, you know, I think something much more collective needs to happen for the world to change. Like it can't just make sense for me to go disappear because then that's just me and my individualism just sort of deciding, well, I'm giving up on the world. It's never going to get better. All I can do is create a better life for myself and take care of myself and, you know, my few loved ones who want to, you know, travel with me, but I'm just sort of giving up, you know. My impulse is to find a way to kind of bring the world along with me. And maybe that's just messianic and grandiose and narcissistic. And maybe that's a cover for actually just my addiction to the narcissism and the superficiality of my world. But that, I think that's where it feels like there's a real dilemma for me. That is it a real binary of you're either in the world as it is or you escape the world. Mm-hmm. But the world itself is not going to change or get better.
Well, okay. What comes up for me when you say that is that it's a both and in that, I mean, that is the $1 million question really at the core for all of us today is how do we live a life that is, it's going to be tied into the modern life. Like we're not going to, I don't think actually there is really a way to escape. What confuses me a bit is like, I think like, well, look, Chris, if you left New York City, let's say you got a teaching job at a different university in any other state, and you continued to be a writer and write, I don't see that at all as binary. I see that just as sort of a different avenue going in the same direction. It's more like how you shift that internal drive. And I agree that, like, I feel that same addiction to the game. And I would argue that's really what's driven myself since I was a little kid, that idea of having attention. And at first, like when we met when I was an actor and, you know, yes, I loved being creative and I loved how it made me feel. I mean, there's something true and beautiful about that. But I was also trying to like play inside like everybody else, the Hollywood system and get famous and make money and the whole thing. And I shifted over to music partially because I was disillusioned with the acting world and Hollywood and that whole thing. And partially because the music felt like much more pure and satisfying to what I was expressing. But the way you do anything in our world is now you put that onto the avenue of the game. And there's all these ways to quantify your success with all these different numbers and all the things. And I feel that drive too of what could I tweak and shift that would make me feel less addicted. But I know that I'm always going to have that level of addiction on some level. And I see it kind of as like, it's just sort of part of me being human. And I try to not make it binary. Like I want that, or I am going to be addicted or I'm not, or I'm in the game or I'm out of the game. Cause I think about, well, you know, the game is serving a purpose. Like it's sort of the fuel that is the fire in this human condition for me to even do it. It's sort of like the grist for the mill, because it gives me drive, and it's not the whole game. It's not the whole cake for me. I want it to just sort of be the icing or one ingredient in the cake, but I have to recognize that like it's going to be there. Just like my ego is going to be part of my psyche, and anger and despair is going to be part of my experience at times, but it's not all of me. And I'm going to move through that. And oh, if I can't change that, it's more like, well, I want to keep an eye on it. But I started to try to shift my thinking of it and being like, well, I'm grateful that I had that drive too, because I also wouldn't be probably doing all this stuff, which also gives me a lot of deep satisfaction, probably in the same way, like when you have witnessed some of your plays being produced, the game played a big part, the drive in that happening, right? And you being the playwright and writing the play and all the stuff you have to do to get something like that produced. But I'm sure that there is this beautiful satisfaction in you too of just like you witnessing that. I'm like, wow, this is amazing. Like, this is so cool to see this happening. I love that. And that joyfulness, that's good. That's okay. And it's tied up with the game.
I think what you're saying is really interesting, and I think there's a lot of truth to it. I think what I get confused about is, maybe the way to say it is, I sometimes think, okay, I am somebody who expects too much from myself and expects too much from the world. And mm-hmm. you know, to return for a moment to kind of what we've all witnessed during lockdown, there's just some people who can't take in what's happening, or they don't want to. There's people for whom the economy, in the most strict superficial sense, is more important than, you know, people living or dying. There's, you know, people arguing that, right, you know, losing the elderly and, you know, people with pre-existing conditions is just the price you pay, you know, but you have to keep the economy going, things like this. Mm-hmm. I want to be really critical of these people. I want to be obviously, you know, critical of all the oppression and racism and all the horrors that we've been seeing in this period. But, you know, I also want to accept that, you know, what you just said, that we're all complex. We all have a lot in us, and it's not all good. and no one's perfect. And I think for me, where I get hung up is, you know, what is the line between accepting we're not perfect, you know, I still have Amazon Prime, you know, whatever, you know, the things I do that I think I really don't want to do it, but I still do it. Mm-hmm. Should I be forgiving those parts of myself, and in both in myself and, you know, in others, should I be forgiving of the flaws in others? Or should I say, no, like, we got to do better. You know, we have to change the world. Right. And I find it really tricky. And I really think it's one reason. I don't know if you're watching The Vow on HBO, the documentary series about NXIVM. There's still tons of press about Scientology. Leah Remini has a podcast now. Like, you know, these cults, both these cults are very small and in some sense irrelevant, right? Like NXIVM only had a few thousand people in it. Scientology probably only has 20, 30,000 people in it. But mm-hmm. I feel like the reason as a culture we're becoming more and more obsessed with stories about these cults is what they did very brilliantly was tie personal fulfillment to changing the world, right? So Scientology is, you know, they believe that they are saving the world. And Keith Raniere and NXIVM, you know, said that NXIVM was the most ethical organization on the planet, right? Like, we have a desire to improve ourselves, but we also have a desire to make the world better. And I feel like capitalism, you know, to put it mildly, does not seem particularly concerned with making the world better. It seems concerned with making individuals wealthy, you know. So it feels like to me, okay, if I'm really in the game, I'm not doing anything for the world. And to what extent that's just okay, and I have to accept that we're imperfect and we're in a system that we can't change, and to what extent that is exactly the evil of that system, that it makes you believe that, hey, you know, there's not much you can do. You know, that, like, my shadow self that watches these cult shows imagining how I could get sucked into a cult, it's that element of, like, being a part of something larger and doing something to improve the world. I mean, obviously those cults do literally nothing to improve the world, but, like, where does that energy go? And, you know, I'd be curious to hear where that energy is for you outside of yourself, of wanting the world to be better. What do you do, or how do you frame that part of things?
Well, I mean, two things are coming up here. One is I've always felt that change you're talking about that helps the world comes from the inside out, from the individual out. But I bet that's the same language they use in the NXIVM or Scientology in a way, which starts to give me a bit of pause. I do believe that's how change happens. People make choices on an individual level that start to ripple out into collective choices. And some of it is like there's a grand psyche about this, that we see this sort of progressive slow shifts over time. But to me, it does come down to, like, those things that maybe don't feel like they're directly influencing the world on your internal level, they do matter to me. And that is where it starts. Like, the way I actually think in my head and treat myself is the seed, you know, for everything else that comes out of that. And I may think that I'm hearing you, now correct me if I'm wrong, I'm hearing you say, like, if I'm, I may think that, well, I'm helping the world, or I feel like I am, by putting out experiences or music or talks, whatever they are, that are helping people think and change and plant their own seeds. But I guess the other side, maybe you're saying, is I look at you, I'm like, well, you're an artist, Chris. I mean, you're commenting on this whole thing and doing the same thing for people in your way. But are you saying that, like, because it is inside of the game, like, let's just call it capitalism or whatever, it's inherently broken?
That's my fear. That's my fear. Uh-huh. And, you know, like, I think of Hamlet as being a play about that. that like the reason he doesn't know what to do, the reason he's not sure if he should take revenge on behalf of his father, is that he realizes he's in a game. And once you realize everything's a game, it's really hard to act because it all feels like it's just feeding this game that's larger than you, and that you can't transcend, you can't escape. And I'm not saying that's what I think is, you know, the full reality.
It's an
reality,
idea. Yeah.
But it's something that I want to consider, because I feel like it's possible that is a major dynamic, that we're all stuck in this thing, and we, you know, kind of fantasize ways to change it, but that is part of the game itself, that it was built that way, it was designed that way. And, you know, so that's like the Hamlet in me that's like striving to think, wait, is there some other way to subvert this system? Is there some other than the ways that, you know, are that seem available to me? And, you know, again, maybe that is a narcissistic pursuit, and maybe that is equally self-obsessed than somebody who just enjoys, you know, exploiting the system and maximizing, you know, their benefits from it. So yeah, I find it all very confusing, but I want to hold that as a possibility, that the work I do as an artist is essentially part of the distraction machine, that the social dilemma, you know, that documentary you referenced, that it's not just what's on our phones, but that, and I don't think I would have said this even 10 years ago, certainly not 20 years ago, the technology has so changed everything that like everything's a part of the game now. Everything is filtered through these devices. And so the kind of traditional paths of creating change have become ineffective and even maybe counterproductive. And so like another example of this would be, we saw tremendous protest movements after George Floyd's murder. And after about 2 months, that energy started to sort of fade away and get absorbed elsewhere. And now it seems mostly channeled, you know, into another election that, you know, God knows, I hope Joe Biden wins it. But, you know, I don't think that is going to solve really any of our problems, just mitigate.
Right.
The worst. But, you know, again, like maybe protest movements did something in the 60s and the 70s and 80s that even with that same energy still there today, they can't quite do in the same way, because everything's mediated through these screens and through these social media sites, you know, that are kind of a parallel reality. So that's me giving voice. I don't want to sound too like doom and gloomy, but that's me giving voice to the more pessimistic or cynical side of me that is anxious that the traditional methods of changing the world no longer have any potency.
I think you're right. I do think the traditional methods on many different levels no longer have their potency. I mean, that goes back to how we started this conversation, in that like even the tools that we use, we don't even know what they are quite anymore. And it's a very destabilizing place to be. When you say like, Chris, I mean, I just want to speak to you, this as a friend, when I hear about worried about your own narcissism in sort of like the pursuit of your own happiness or your efficacy in the world. I mean, instead of narcissism, I see it like as a form of nihilism that's more a symptom of the collapse. There's a collapse inside our own minds that is okay. Like that is a burning of a field of your own psyche that we're still in process with. And I really believe that I've seen your work, and even if I like it, but even if I didn't, it's like the fact that you're making it to me that is subverting a story. It's subverting the dream that we're in, that everything's okay. And there's a part of you showing us that, well, it's not. There is pain. And there's only thing we can do to alleviate pain is to point the ship in a certain direction, to just say, I'm going to head towards that horizon. I'm making that choice. But we know the storms will continue. But that's all we can do is the intent. And the intent is not something that I see as, I mean, perhaps it's narcissistic by nature, but there's something beautiful about that too. And it's all we can do is a sort of witness one another making those choices and say, I'll head that way with you too. And I might get lost or I might change my mind. I might abandon you. But what else is there to do? And I honor you for doing that in the past. And yes, we're going up against a kind of like a Goliath that seems like it will never change. But maybe that's just kind of the playing field we're on. You look at the change that there has been a kind of growth over time, sure, that we can see in the big, big epochs of time. And concurrently, things get more complicated, in some ways worse, just in different ways. But hey, maybe it is going to all crash and burn. Maybe this is the sixth great collapse, you know, on this planet. And there are many indigenous stories have spoken about there are times just like this where, you know, civilizations that reach their peaks have collapsed completely. And, you know, we don't even know about. And whether you believe that or not, that's in all the myths. And it's just part of the cycles of creation. So it's sort of like all across the universe, too, is the story is that, like, this is the opportunity that is built up through the playing field of Newtonian physics and quantum physics and evolution. And this is how it works. And sort of like beings and souls were given opportunities to keep trying, and we'll just keep trying. but an evolution is happening, and this is how it happens. And it's messy, and it's ugly, and it's terrible, and it's beautiful. And that doesn't change that I agree with like a lot of what you're saying. And I'm trying to like feel that against what I was trying to speak to before. That why am I also sometimes like when I look outside right now, it's like it's just beautiful, and I also know what's going on in the world. And those have to coexist with me together, sort of the sacred and the profane. Yeah. And I've seen that in your work, and I think like that's what I honor about you. That's what I celebrate about you. Not like did it change the thing, or you know, did it work better or not better? It's like, well, it's kind of it's both, and it's in the game. Right. Like, and it's, but it also just came from you sitting somewhere in your apartment writing. Like, where did that, you know, it's beautiful and it's horror in a way.
Yeah. And listening to you, it makes me think too about how, you know, there's a narcissism and expectations. I mean, we are, you know, our lives may be long to us, but they're obviously short in relation to history. And, you know, we can't presume to know where we're headed and yeah. what things we do today will reverberate, you know, in the decades and centuries to come. And, you know, at the same time, I think it's good to be aware of the, this is also, I think, an overcoming of narcissism to realize you could be in one of these difficult periods that, you know, have an apocalyptic structure. And, you know, that is also just part of life, part of history, that there is destruction. I think probably for me, I hate seeing people suffer. It's really painful to witness suffering. Mm-hmm. And so that motivates me to want something better and to be participating in something better. But, you know, you can't always guarantee positive results. And that's just part of being alive. And, you know, certainly part of what I learned, you know, watching people I was treated with, you know, die, that, you know, that these things in some profound way are random. And whether the life forces or the death forces are more powerful, just, you know, is chance. And our desire to avoid suffering and our desire to improve the world those desires aren't magic. They're not omnipotent. You know, that they do battle with other forces. And, you know, I try to have humility and I try to accept all of that. But it is hard because it's, you know, it's also quite a painful thing.
Yeah, life is hard, as our friend Anton Dudley said. He always would tell me, life is so long. In his mind, he just thought it was like this long episode. And I wanted to ask Chris, I mean, I know things have shifted a lot in the world of theater. It's pretty much shut down. And how much has like your creativity and creative process played a role, though, in your kind of personal fire and ability to walk through all this stuff in the world? Like, has that been waned during this, or are you still feeling really connected to that? Or is it not really like part of your well-being?
It's a really good question. I mean, I think probably we're all being creative just to kind of get through this. I mean, even if we're not getting through it, if it doesn't feel like we're getting through it in a way where we're like thriving and everything's amazing, just to get through it at all, I think probably requires a lot of creativity. You know, to not have access to usual social channels and economic activity and, you know, all the things that give us energy. And I think that requires a lot of mental work. To the extent that I've stayed relatively psychologically healthy and I'm not addicted to anything probably other than my phone, you know, that I'm using my mind to find ways to process what I'm feeling. I definitely think there's creative talent and skill in having done that. But, you know, I think that's probably a universal creativity that we all have. And, you know, some people have had more access to it than others and maybe had it more nurtured than others did. But, you know, as critical as I can be of myself and others, I think, you know, we also have to give a lot of credit that we have, you know, gotten through what, 6-7 plus months of complete shocking change to daily life, robbing us, you know, many of the joys and pleasures that help give our lives meaning. So, yeah, I mean, I think probably I'm doing what everybody else has done. And, you know, maybe just because I've been able to nurture my creativity through my career for the last couple decades, you know, maybe I've had a little more practice, and certainly, you know, had a lot of practice when I was sick, when I really could do it, even less than you can do in a lockdown. So, you know, but also maybe part of me is wondering like, how long can that last? You know, I think we're all eager to move on to whatever the next thing is, but we probably have, you know, 6+ months at least of what we're going through now ahead. Mm-hmm. I'm curious to see how well our collective creativity holds up. And I am worried about violence in the country and that, you know, people are going to shut down and addiction will increase and violence against out groups will increase, scapegoating, all that stuff. And, you know, and if we have to witness that, then part of our task with our creativity is going to be how do we respond to a world that is getting bleaker and more violent. So yeah, I think creativity is central, but I think it not only has it had a lot of work to do already, but I think it's going to have a lot more work to do.
Are you writing, or have you been before this?
I am hoping to start writing. I feel like for the first 4 months of lockdown, I really was just trying to take everything in. And I really wanted to learn too about epidemiology. You know, I got very curious about the virus and probably spent 3-4 hours a day reading about it. But yeah, I haven't really felt the desire to write. I think partly to do with not knowing what the world will be. You know, I think I've always written things like, okay, this is what the world is, and I want my play to exist in tension with the world. So not really knowing where the world's going makes it hard, because I'm so used to that, like the structuring tension of the piece being, how is my vision different from what I feel like the dominant mainstream thing is in the world? So now I'm like, I don't know what the world's going to be. And so that the whole way I've written is sort of out the window. So either I have to wait till I have a sense of what the world's going to be, or I'll find like a new way of generating tension. That whatever that way is, it hasn't presented itself to me yet.
Are you thinking about whether or not to write for theater? Like, what are your thoughts on that returning in any way?
I have this play that if there was no COVID, it would literally be on in England right now. So having a play that's like ready to go and is sort of on indefinite hold, I think makes it hard to think about writing a new one. There's just something nice about you finish one and then you move on. But I have a couple plays that are under commission, and I'm sort of thinking of them in a very kind of a gentle kind of long-term way, sort of letting the ideas, just very, very slowly develop. I'm not trying to force anything. I sort of thinking about a nonfiction book, or I am thinking about a nonfiction book. I'm sort of thinking of a kind of memoir, but a memoir that I would actually like to read. So like a memoir that would be a lot more about the world and than about me. And that could be, you know, an exciting new challenge to shift into a different kind of writing, and something more immediate and direct, you know, just between my words and the reader. And I'm working on a horror movie with a friend, which I'm quite excited about, which is very different for me and very cool. So yeah, I'm trying to think of new ways to write, and trying to leave the field of possibility as open as possible.
Well, when you said writing a nonfiction memoir is more direct, that's why I left the acting world and why I shifted in the music. You're just saying it better than I was before, but it just felt like, oh, now this is way more, there's less shit in between the feeling inside and the expression outside. I mean, it was maddening being an actor. When, you know how it goes, it's like, it's so hard to get work. And then when you do, the odds of it being something good or that you enjoy is low. And even if it is, it doesn't last long. If it's a TV show, it could be a day or a week. If it's a play, it's a couple months and then it's over. And then even when you do hit something special, more than likely, if it does take off, you could be probably be replaced by a movie star. And it was tough. It felt like being at the bottom, like a pawn on a chessboard of this thing. And it would hit sometimes, but it was very difficult to do that all amidst inside that big game. And so music was, especially, it's one of the reasons I ultimately started a solo project essentially with East Forest, was to be able to, I want to be able to do it when other people are not around. And sort of like during the pandemic, that's been a blessing to be able to actually like be in the studio and write and produce music in the same way I did before. It was challenging to get other musicians to play on it, but that wasn't like a requirement, like when a band member quits or something, or like the people who produced the thing, like the play, are like, okay, that's not happening anymore. We're shutting down theater. It's like, whoa, hold up.
Yeah.
So I love the idea of you writing I think it'd be really cool. And it would also be like, I think that's really, really interesting to have less in the way between you and your thoughts, your ideas, and that core impulse and the people's ingestion of it just by reading it.
Well, yeah. And like listening to you now, I mean, you could hear the excitement in your voice describing that process of, you know, creating an artistic practice that allowed you direct access to your audience without all these mediating factors. And I think that is also part of why, you know, podcasts have taken off. That,
yeah.
You know, it allows you to be yourself and communicate in the way you want to with who you want to. And, you know, I do think that this old system where there's some kind of moneyed other that packages representation of reality for the maximum audience, potential audience. You know, like the part you left out of how annoying being an actor is when an idiot director is like telling you how to say the friggin' line. Like, you're like, no, that's not good or true. But that, you know, that like the those pressures, you know, typically have been universal and inescapable, like, you know. And, you know, it does feel one of the upsides of technology is it's allowing people to do their own thing more easily and to get it to people more directly. And, you know, I think that is very special and certainly something I want to explore more, that more direct, immediate relationship.
Well, things are always potentially bigger and more amazing through collaboration. They're just riskier and harder. So, I mean, that's why when something does hit that is so collaborative, like a film or a play, and it, when it is really great, it's really great. Yeah. And there's a beauty that it is just a moment in time. It's just hard for the players in it, so to speak. It is going to be a moment in time.
Yeah, and it is incredibly special. And I think to link it back to lockdown, I think what so many of us have realized is that we do want to be around other people. We do want social connection, even if we really value our private time and isolation. You know, there is a desire to collaborate in us that is strong, to be together. And, you know, even when the gyms opened up here a couple of weeks ago, it was like, oh, it's just nice to be in a room with strangers, you know, just to feel the reality of other people outside of my, you know, my little network of friends. And so, yeah, I'm not giving up on collaboration fully by any means. But yeah, it is harder. And it's harder and harder the more, you know, capitalism imposes itself. So, you know, I think it's nice to, you know, to consider these more direct, intimate, immediate ways of communicating. But yeah, you're right. We have to keep that larger collaborative spirit alive as well, because when it goes right, it is, you know, indescribably special.
And you could say that's what's the whole thing is, this larger collaborative spirit of us as a people, whether it's a family or a nation state or a whole planet. And boy, that's a big one. And sure, it is hard and it comes and goes, but that's how we get the biggest result and the biggest reward. And so I don't know if through this conversation you're feeling any more clarity about how you're processing what's going on, but I think I want to just echo my realization after I asked that question is that there also isn't really an answer. There's just more words on the page, more notes in the chorus. And maybe, you know, this will just continue to reverberate for us and we'll pay attention to our dreams and see if it makes more sense to us as we're spoken to from the more tender parts of our minds. We'll see.
Yeah. And I think at the very least, we gave voice to a lot of different energies and, you know, being as comprehensive as possible about everything that we're feeling and that's happening inside of us and in the world. I mean, that I think is so important. And even if it doesn't lead to answers, you just feel better because you've given voice to stuff that's happening inside.
Christopher Shin, thank you for joining us again. I'll link up to your stuff and I hope we can continue our convo over time.
I would absolutely love that, Trevor.
Thanks, buddy.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Shin, for joining us again. I'm hopeful and would hope that I'm sure we'll have him back at some point. It's always great to talk to good friends. This music you're hearing in the background is called Deliquesce, and it was the second single or release from the Spores album that is now out wherever you listen to music. The entire album digitally will be out this Friday on the new moon, October 16th. And if you want to get the vinyl, it's also released on vinyl, this album, you can do that at eastforest.org. This music was also from a ceremony, kind of like the Spores ceremony concert that's on YouTube. Well, the Spores album is from the Music for Mushrooms album, which is from a live Medicine Journey ceremony. So it's a unique and different way of writing and producing music, but I think it produces at times a very unique and singular result. So you're hearing music that's being birthed in the moment. And if I've actually never played that song again, and if I ever wanted to try, I'd have to, just like you, have to listen to it and reverse engineer it and try to learn it, try to figure out what the hell happened in that moment. So that's always an interesting exercise. Thanks for reviewing the podcast. Thank you for subscribing. Thank you to Chris again. And you guys keep walking your walk. Don't take any shit. But if you do, you know what to do. You just do it with grace.